Thanks, Michael. So sorry, that wasn't advertised. I had sent it, but somewhere it disappeared somewhere. Here's the title, and I guess the my plan was to you know, go through first of all an overview of the kinds of experiments that we've been doing at Penn State and also with my collaborators elsewhere at Santa Barbara and elsewhere. And then after that, I wanted to look at a couple of recent experiments that we've been doing in my group. One is an experiment where we've been trying to look at the look for the spin valve effect in gallium manganese arsenide based devices. And I think we're reasonably certain that we are actually seeing a spin valve effect due to spin dependent scattering in properly made trilayer devices. And I'll try to convince you about that. But I'll also show you that it's not as obvious and it's kind of complicated. And then after that, I want to address a little bit about experiments that we've been trying to do, partly trying to reproduce Hideo Ono's experiments on domain wall manipulation. And there isn't going to be as detailed experimental data or analysis over here, because the story that I want to at least get to is that it looks like, at least from our end, in trying to get at intrinsic physics in this, I'm trying to be a little bit cautious, because it appears that if you study many, many devices, there are extrinsic effects that clearly dominate what's going on. And then if I have the time after this, after covering these two topics, since I wanted to cut a sort of broad swath of the experiments we've been doing, I also wanted to discuss briefly some of the recent experiments we've done over the last couple of years on interfacial control of ferromagnetism. And one is on exchange biasing. So clearly for people who make metallic ferromagnets, exchange biasing is not such a big deal. But in gallium manganese arsenide, it took us quite a while to work this out. And I think it actually raises some... There were many materials issues that needed to get solved before we could succeed in doing this. But now that we have it sort of worked out, I would be interested at least in presenting these results and see if I might be able to talk to people about interesting basic experiments that one can do now that we have this under control. And then I want to talk a little bit about engineering the Curie temperature in gallium manganese arsenide by doing nano patterning. And again, when you see some of the transport data over there, I think there are some curious issues that come up in these kinds of structures. So without losing any time then, my general interest in my group is to make all sorts of interesting materials. And we've been focusing on a wide range of materials, which includes paramagnetic semiconductors, ferromagnetic semiconductors, some ferromagnetic metals, and also antiferromagnets. And we choose all the materials from classes of systems where we know how to pattern things and where we can do good lithography and you know, good processing and so on, and that leads to a variety of interesting systems like microdiscs and cantilevers. These are cantilevers that were made from in a collaboration with David's group here, Dave Avshalom's group here, and then there are these kinds of submicron devices that I'll talk a little bit about today, and then also just patterning ferromagnetic metals into frustrated arrays. And you've heard Peter Schiffer, I think, talk about that sometime back as part of this program. So you know, these are the kinds of materials that we deal with. And the general goal, of course, is, as everyone here in this workshop is interested in, is in semiconductor spintronics to some extent. And the overall approaches that we use, well, one approach is simply to create, control, and detect spin polarization of electrons and holes in semiconductors, you can control these using electric fields and exchange interactions. And one very elegant example of this, I think, was an experiment that we successfully did last year, again, a collaboration with David's group here, in which we engineered a parabolically shaped quantum well, similar to what David has done before with Art Gossard, except that we used a different material. So this is a material that's a 2-6 semiconductor. And then in the middle of that parabolic quantum well, we place some manganese atoms. So this is a very, compared to something like gallium manganese arsenide, these 2-6 materials doped with manganese have very high optical qualities. You know, you can look at well-resolved quantum states in them. And then the interesting thing that happens is that when the carrier wave function overlaps with the manganese sites, you get a very enhanced G factor. And so if you look at the spin dynamics in such a system, then at in the absence of an electrical bias, if you look at, let's say, time-resolved Kerr rotation as measured in David's group over here, then at zero bias, precession of the electrons is occurs in at a very rapid rate. So it's basically in the terahertz regime at zero bias. But as you apply an electrical bias, then what you land up doing is that you start moving this wave function away from the overlap of the manganese ions, and you can move the electron spin precession purely by electrical means from a regime which is terahertz spin precession to gigahertz spin precession. And one of the interesting things in these types of experiments, incidentally, is that you can also see a transfer of the angular momentum coherently from the holes that you have generated by in these pulsed experiments to the manganese spins themselves. And so if you look at the variation on the time axis of the Kerr rotation, you see this other signal over here, which is persisting long after the electron precession has damped out. And this signal over here is the precession of the manganese spins themselves. So one of the interesting things that one finds is that you can not only affect the carrier spin precession, but you can also, in some sense, affect the manganese spin precession as you apply these electrical biases. So, you know, controlling the exchange interaction with electric fields is something interesting. Another experiment that that we did recently, and the main person who did the measurements here is sitting at the back of the room, Sai Ghosh. These are microdiscs that we that my students figured out how to make at Penn State over the last couple of years, and we've spent a lot of time just learning the processing and getting the processing under really good control for gallium arsenide-based microdiscs so that we can make very high-quality systems. And they function as lasers, just as many people have made microdiscs over the last 20 years or so. But what was unusual about this experiment is that Sai Ghosh and others in David's group did a time-resolved Faraday rotation experiment where they look at the spin lifetime inside this microdisc. And when they look at the spin lifetime as a function of either the excitation wavelength, rather the detection wavelength, and also the as a function of power, they find that there is a region in phase space when the lifetime is highly enhanced. And this enhancement appears to occur when you're resonant with a confined mode of the cavity. And so there are very clear experimental results on this. And it's clear that the spin relaxation time T2 star sort of tracks the Q factor in some sense of the cavity mode, you know, as you pump the cavity with different excitation power. But it's still not understood, and I think Sai will agree that it's not, that we really don't understand this yet at any fundamental level. So it's certainly an open problem at this point, and it's one that we are pursuing experimentally and would love to have some input from people who are interested in looking at this problem. So the key thing is simply that the spin coherence time seems to be enhanced when you're in resonant with the cavity mode, and also when the Q factor increases, the T2 star tracks that, so that when you're right at the transparency threshold of the laser, you find that the T2 star is highly enhanced. So these are the kinds of experiments that we have been pursuing in the context of using photons and electrical biases to control spin dynamics and study spin dynamics in semiconductor quantum structures. Another approach, of course, is to just look at spin transport in both conventional and magnetic semiconductors. And you've heard a number of things here about spin injection and spin Hall effect and so on. And then there are also these ideas that have come out from Michael Flatey and Shankar's group and others on spin diodes, transistors, and magnetic bipolar transistors. And these are really nice theoretical ideas that one would like to pursue. But for example, if you want to make something like a Michael's unipolar spin diode or spin transistor, then you want to be able to make a structure where you have control over the placement of domain walls. And you want to be able to understand how to place these domain walls and how to perhaps move them around. And you need to develop then some control over the switching field of different device elements. So if you want to do this with gallium manganese arsenide, can we exploit shape anisotropy or strain, or can we exchange bias the gallium manganese arsenide, and can we pin the domain walls using, or can we have them movable so that you can reconfigure the arrangement of the device? These are the type of questions that we're interested in answering. So what I want to go on to then is, for the rest of the talk, is focus just on gallium manganese arsenide and talk a little bit about the transport experiments that we've been doing recently. So I don't need to go into all this. I mean, you all know about gallium manganese arsenide and that there is hole-mediated ferromagnetism. And a lot of this slide has remained the same over many, many years, except that perhaps I'm becoming now, because of recent experiments, becoming somewhat convinced that there is that the impurity band in gallium manganese arsenide is playing a role in the ferromagnetism. And I don't know what implications this has for the kinds of experiments that we are doing or how one interprets them, but I'll show you what experimental results we have anyway. And playing a role. I mean, there is an impurity band, which is, I think, what can
are the carriers in the impurity band?
The Fermi level is probably in the impurity band.
So
is what
the
I.
And the
yeah.
Role
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm. Given Birch's experiments, that's what I'm starting to at least get convinced of. So what this implies, of course, in terms of interpreting the ferromagnetism of its dependence on hole density and so on, I don't know. I mean, as I mentioned on the earlier slide, we all know that there is a lot of extrinsic physics in gallium manganese arsenide. And the extrinsic physics in gallium manganese arsenide has to do with the interstitials and the defects, such as arsenic antisites and so on. And we know that by annealing, we can remove these manganese interstitials to the free surface of the sample. And by doing that you can get these Curie temperatures of around 170 Kelvin or thereabouts, or possibly even higher according to Tanaka. One thing that I hope everyone is aware about is that these annealing effects are completely suppressed in heterostructures. And so if we want to think about making interesting devices where the gallium manganese arsenide is somewhere inside your device, then it turns out that you really can't take advantage of these high TCs. So for example, even if you take a layer like this of gallium manganese arsenide of 50 nanometers in thickness, and you anneal it, when this is at the free surface, you clearly see a change in the TC because interstitials move. But if you put even a 10 nanometer cap of gallium arsenide on top of that, that effect is completely suppressed. And we don't have experimental proof as to why it's suppressed, but there's some speculation that these diffusing interstitials, when they make it into this region over here, create a p-n junction at the interface and hence prevent further diffusion. So they sort of limit the diffusion of these interstitials because of that. So this is something just that one needs to bear in mind in dealing with gallium manganese arsenide based devices. Anytime you have a buried layer, there's a problem. Now, of course, you can exploit this idea, and this is what I'm going to talk about for these semiconductor trilayer devices. So the spin valve effect in metallic systems, of course, we all know has been around for roughly 20 years. And the basic idea is just that you have two ferromagnets separated by some non-magnetic layer. And the non-magnetic layer is also a conductor. And then when these ferromagnets are aligned or anti-aligned, then you get a different resistance. And I'm just putting up this equation over here from the GMR literature. Not that it is, it's just for heuristic means. This change in resistance relative to the overall resistance of the device. We know it depends on things like the resistivities of the spin-up and of the minority and majority carriers. It also depends on the ratio of the resistivity of the intermediate layer to the resistivity of the spin-up carriers. And it also then depends on things like the ratios of these thicknesses and so on. So one question is, you know, it's sort of surprising that no one has actually reported strain-dependent scattering or a GMR-type effect or a spin-valve effect in gallium manganese arsenide devices, which are analogous, completely analogous to these metallic systems. There is one paper from Ono's group, roughly about 15 years ago, where the title of the paper is Spin-Dependent Scattering in gallium arsenide or gallium manganese arsenide trilayers. But in that case, this intermediate layer is clearly a tunneling layer. So it's a barrier. And, you know, I think they did see something, a magnetoresistance that changes when you change configurations. But it was very early on in the game, and I'm not completely sure that it's due to spin-dependent scattering. So we wanted to emulate completely what happens in the metallic system. Now, the caveats are that there is a short hole spin diffusion length, probably. We don't have experimental evidence for this. There's certainly a short elastic mean free path. If you look at the just the conductivities or resistivities of gallium manganese arsenide, no matter which sample you get, whether the TC is 170 Kelvin or 150 Kelvin, you know, the best resistivities you get are roughly something like 1 milliohm centimeters or 2 milliohm centimeters thereabouts. It doesn't change very much. But from that, if you were to deduce naively an elastic mean free path, it's very, very short. Furthermore, there is a very strong magnetoresistance intrinsically in gallium manganese arsenide, which can complicate the observation of anything related to a spin valve effect. So, how did we go about doing this? Well, we made trilayers of gallium manganese arsenide, gallium arsenide, gallium manganese arsenide, and then we had developed the doping of this intermediate layer with beryllium so that it has holes in it. We don't know when we make a trilayer like this, of course, we don't know the conductivity of this metal layer as such, but if we just make a thick layer of this and measure its conductivity for the doping levels that we use, then it's certainly better than the conductivity of the gallium manganese arsenide. So we make trilayers of this sort, and you know, wherein this middle layer is clearly conducting, and then we anneal a device like this. Now, when you anneal a device like this, what happens is, as I showed you earlier, this layer over here does not change its magnetic properties. This one does. And this is a trick that, again, Chiba and company from Tohoku has exploited in the past. So we just use this annealing trick to make these two ferromagnetic layers different from each other in their coercive fields and so on. So here's a summary of the data. This is RxX, this is RxY as a function of field for one device in which the spacer thickness is just 5 nanometers. I'll show you data for different spacer thicknesses also later. So even in the as-grown device, if you look at RxX, you see that there's clearly some interesting magnetoresistance there, and that pretty much resembles what you see in just a single epilayer of gallium manganese arsenide. And you know, it's due to the domain reorientations that occur as you change the as you reverse the magnetic field. Now, as you anneal a device like this, yeah. No, this is so here it is. So this is the Hall bar as seen from above, and the magnetic field is purposely put at an angle to the current. Okay. Yes, current right, CIP or current in plane type of geometry. And so, as you take a device like this, and then you anneal it for different amounts of time, you see that there is some structure that starts emerging over here. If you now measure the planar Hall effect at the same time, then by measuring the planar Hall effect, you can actually start tracking what is the orientation of the magnetizations of these two layers. And I'm not going to show you all the detailed analysis of this data, but you know, believe me, you can write down simple equations that pretend that this is, of course, a single domain system, and you can model the Hall effect, and you start seeing now this, you know, you start seeing a different ledge over here that corresponds to two different switching fields. Now, what's interesting in these types of gallium manganese arsenide devices is that the magnetization switches by 90 degrees. So the easy axis in these devices is along 100, which is at 45 degrees to this. And then every time the magnetization switches, it goes by 90 degrees. And so the layers do this. You know, one layer switches like this, then the other one switches like this, then they switch again, and then they... So we never achieve an anti-parallel arrangement, at least in the devices we've made so far, but we do achieve orthogonal arrangements. And now I'll show you some data that looks at this a little bit more in detail. So here is RXX and here is RXY. And in cartoon form over here, I've shown you the relative orientations of the magnetizations as we deduce them from the planar Hall effect, from the analysis of the planar Hall effect. So here they are parallel to each other. And if you just track this blue curve over here, then they switch. And when they switch over here, you see that there is this structure in the magnetoresistance. They become parallel here, and then they switch to orthogonal orientations, and there is this structure again. And what's unusual is that there is actually a dip. So it looks like a double peak, but it's not actually a double peak. What's happening over here is that there is a GMR peak, and there is a competing effect from the from the magnetoresistance that's intrinsic to the gallium manganese arsenide. There is a model for this magnetoresistance. It's based on a model by Nagaev called, and it has to do with magneto-impurity scattering. But if you look at that model, then the magnetoresistance goes exactly in the opposite direction of what the spin valve effect goes. So right at the point where the spin valve effect is going to be a maximum, there is a competing effect that creates this dip over here. And the same thing happens for the GMR peak that would occur over here. You get a dip over there. So we've looked at devices like this in some detail and done some modeling and not simulating the entire curves, but just trying to get a heuristic picture of what's going on here. And it makes sense. And another way in which you convince yourself that there is a spin valve effect is that if you study the temperature dependence, then because of the annealing that we've done to these layers, one of them has a TC of, this one has a TC of 60 Kelvin, this one has a TC of 90 Kelvin. And so as you approach 60 Kelvin, you see that these additional peaks over here, they disappear. There is still, of course, a magnetoresistance that survives, but that's simply from the single layer magnetoresistance that's from the top. This next piece of evidence that I want to just present is that if you now look at the spacer thickness dependence, remember one of the things I said is that one expects that the whole spin diffusion length in gallium manganese arsenide must be quite short. And I don't know of any experiment, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, that actually probes this in any direct way. We thought it would be a few nanometers or something like that. So we varied the spacer thickness 2 nanometers, 5 nanometers, and 10 nanometers. We haven't done it continuously. We haven't made a wedge or anything like that. But we've made several devices of each kind. I mean, several samples and several devices. And the features we see here are pretty generic. So this is the single layer. That's the control measurement. With 2 nanometers, we see something that sort of resembles this single layer. I mean, it appears that just with a very thin spacer, it seems to be acting as just one, the layers just act as if they are coupled in some way. We haven't been able to understand this in much detail, but it looks like sort of single layer physics. When we go to a 10 nanometer spacer, where the thickness is now much larger, presumably, than the whole spin diffusion length, then we no longer see these GMR peaks again. And again, I want to stress that you can make several samples of this and make devices from each of these different growths, and you always see these kinds of features when you have a spacer which is, 5 plus or minus 1 nanometer, and if you exceed something like 8 nanometers, then you start getting very different kind of physics. So our speculation is that as you go to 10 nanometer spacers, then the whole spin diffusion length is shorter than the spacer thickness, and so the GMR physics goes away. The other thing that we think is happening with, I want to point out that all of these devices have been annealed at 190 degrees centigrade. This GMR in every device only, GMR is the wrong word for it, it's not giant, but the spin valve effect only emerges when we anneal the samples. And so, again, a speculation is that we are creating spin-dependent scattering, presumably by doing something at the interfaces. But maybe because the interstitials are moving and making the interfaces look rougher or something like that. These experiments, like I said, are one of the motivations we have for doing these is that we would like to do spin-torque devices but based on such GMR systems where they're completely conducting rather than have a tunnel layer as Ono has done.
Yeah. Usually find very useful to do also a controlled rotation experiment.
No, we don't have a rotating field. So so we
are extremely strong here. Often when we do sweep experiments, we get sweep experiments, and then you know, we get some complicated structure.
Sure.
It becomes very clear what's going on when you do the rotation.
Right. So we haven't done a continuous rotation, but in the paper we are writing up, we do show data at other crystalline orientations, mm-hmm. and that helps resolve things a little bit more.
Right.
But I would love to, you know, in David's group, they do have a vector magnet. So
because then you can very nicely distinguish what's due to some non-collinearity in the device,
right.
and what's really AMR.
Right.
It could be AMR, normal AMR. It could be something AMR connected with your having an interface is there or tunnel
yeah.
AMR and things like that. So.
It certainly could be. I mean, right now I'm inclining more towards this interpretation of a spin valve type thing. But I agree that you do have to extricate. And I think the key point is that until we started doing these experiments, you know, we didn't really realize how big all these other magnetoresistance effects are in gallium manganese arsenide, and they really do make things complicated. You know, so the next. Topic I wanted to cover is I wanted to show you some of the experiments we've been doing on pinning and controlling domain walls in gallium manganese arsenide devices. And again, part of the motivation for this was from Michael's idea of these unipolar spin transistor type ideas, where you want to have a system in which you have a three-element device like this with spin up, spin down, spin up, or you know, different domain orientations, and so we wanted to see if we could do this with gallium manganese arsenide. So using e-beam lithography, we started making patterns of this kind, where we make islands of different shapes. And our naive expectation was that it's very simple. You just make islands of different shapes, and then you get shape anisotropy, and islands will switch with different coercive fields. And indeed, when you make gallium manganese arsenide devices like this, that does happen. But after having studied about 10 devices, one thing I can very confidently say, that it appears that shape anisotropy is not what determines switching fields in devices of gallium manganese arsenide that are patterned like this. It must be something else. It has to be something like, you know, when you pattern the structure, the due to depletion or something, your carrier density changes. I don't know what it is, but if you make shapes of different kinds, then the switching fields do not follow the naive expectations. They sometimes do, and sometimes they don't. So you expect, a certain coercive, qualitatively different coercive field for an island of different shape, and it doesn't occur like that. But in any case, you can make pattern devices, and you can measure the magnetization of each of these islands using Hall probes. So these are gallium manganese arsenide layers which are grown stressed with tensile strain on InGaAs. And so because of this tensile strain, the EZ axis is perpendicular to the plane. And so when you measure the Hall effect across these, you measure an anomalous Hall effect. And the anomalous Hall effect then shows you that the switching fields for these different devices for the different regions can be different. And for example, for this big island over here, it's a little bit more complicated, suggesting that there's perhaps a two-domain structure or something like that, you know, as you sweep the field. So now we want to find out whether we can detect the pinning of a domain wall at these notches. Well, clearly from the Hall data, if you just keep track of the signs of your Hall signal, you can convince yourself, whether the anomalous Hall effect here is of the opposite sign as over here. And that way you can convince yourself that there's a domain wall in between. But there's a more straightforward way that we found out for detecting the presence of domain walls. And this works with these perpendicular anisotropy systems, even when the domain wall resistance itself is, of course, very, very small. So if you take a device like this, and let's say you measure the longitudinal resistance across DE and across AB, then this is what you see. So as you sweep up, you get a structure like this, as one of these islands switches and then the other island switches, so it looks sort of like a spin valve effect, You know, it appears like when you're measuring RxX, you get a different resistance when these are oppositely oriented, and then when they're all the same orientation, you're back to the same resistance over here. But when you sweep the magnetic field in the opposite direction, this actually goes the opposite way. So it's anti-symmetric in field. And if you go and measure, say, AB versus DE, you find that there is a sort of a mirror symmetry in between these. And so that right away tells you that what you're actually measuring is not due to any kind of spin valve effect or anything like that, but it's simply due to the anomalous Hall effect contributing to RxX. And this is because when you have a domain wall located between these two contacts, then one of the effects of that domain wall is that it creates circulating currents in the vicinity of the spin domain wall. And so as a result of these circulating currents, when you measure RxX, you're actually measuring an RxY contribution to RxX. But this provides a very nice way to detect and locate domain walls that are pinned in a device. So using devices like this, we actually tried to reproduce Ono's electrically driven domain wall experiments. But it turns out that in these submicron devices, even when we are really blasting the device to the extent of burning them out, we can't move these domain walls at all. They seem to be just stuck there until you blow up the device. And so we decided then instead to go back to the kind of device that Hideo Ono talked about and has written extensively about. And that's a trilayer device, rather a three-element device, in which you use wet etching to make a step like this. Okay, so this element here is 24 nanometers in thickness. This one is 16 nanometers, and this one is 30 nanometers in thickness. And we just do this by wet etching, and then we use the effect that I talked about in the earlier page. You know, the seeing that anti-symmetric magnetoresistance to make sure that we have. We sweep up in field, come down, and make sure that we have a domain wall pinned over here, and a domain wall pinned over here, rather, in this cartoon. And then we start sending current pulses. The current pulses are 100 milliseconds in width, and a positive pulse in this scheme over here corresponds to current going like this. And then we send alternating up and down pulses. So a pulse comes like this, a pulse comes like that, pulse comes like this, pulse comes like that. And then you measure the Hall effect across these different elements. So if you measure the Hall effect across E and B, that's the black curve over here, you see that when a current pulse goes from this side, there's a domain wall that comes from this end and hits this ledge over here. And so this Hall signal for this middle element switches, and when the pulse comes in the opposite direction, it goes back up. And so it keeps switching like this. Now, unfortunately, we don't have imaging. So all I can say is that this is what the Hall effect signal is doing. And that indicates that there is a domain wall going by the contacts that we've placed in the middle, right? So there's no way here we have of other than just making a very rough estimate of domain wall velocity. We can't actually measure the domain wall velocity right now. We are making new devices now where we have multiple probes, and then we can just do a time-resolved measurement and try to track the domain wall velocity as the domain walls move by. Yeah. Okay. No. So the Curie temperature of this particular device is about, if I remember right, 75 or 80 Kelvin. And so we've studied. So what we do is that we prepare the domain wall at 5 Kelvin, and then we start warming up the device, and we find that. You really cannot. We can't do any of this domain wall manipulation once we are something like 15 degrees or so below the Curie temperature. So you have a very narrow window of about 15 Kelvin at most in which you can monitor this. Sure. I mean, we have done. Of course, and. We tried that over there, and I don't understand why it wasn't working there. But over here, clearly, you have to go. You have to go to temperatures which are very close to the Curie temperature. The one thing, by the way, I just wanted to note is that. What did I do here? It's a new controller here, so. Let me just move back. slow. Okay. So let me just. Well, I mean, we've looked at different temperatures, but here, and so you must be wondering, well, if you've looked at different temperatures, why not show, you know, things like threshold current density or something like this as a function of temperature? And here's my caveat. Here's what worries me a little bit. We've looked at many devices, and you know, you can certainly generate a set of curves like this. And remember, we are not imaging, so we're just measuring this Hall effect. You can certainly generate a set of curves like this, and by varying the current at a given temperature, you can tell yourself that, okay, I'm going to decide that the threshold current density is going to be something that allows me to do this complete switching. So if I see curves like this where there's not complete switching, then I'm not going to say that it's actually at, I'm launching these domain walls on it. Whereas over here, I would say I am. But the problem is that on every cooldown, and even for a given device, if you cool down 10 different times, you get different results. And so I'm very worried about trying to extract any intrinsic physics from these type of devices at this point. There are some differences between the devices that Hideo has made and that we have made. And there's some details in the buffer layer structure and so on, which perhaps plays a role. So perhaps he has better control devices. But I'm just putting a caveat over here that when one tries to do these experiments with gallium manganese arsenide, there are some tricky issues involved, I think. But at least we can demonstrate it and we can do it. And there are other odd things that we find. So for example, this is now at 65 Kelvin. And we've gone to 65 Kelvin and we're using a pulse height, a current which is somewhat large, 150 microamps. And then look at this. The red curve over here is a curve that corresponds to starting out with a device that's set like this. So you cool it down, you pin a domain wall over here, you now warm it up and start doing all your measurements, and you try to figure out, you know, at what the current threshold does this device start switching. And you get it switching, let's say, at 150 microamps. You now take the same device, cool it down, you pin the domain wall at another place, at the other interface, and you find that the threshold for that can be very different at that same temperature. So for example, at this 150 microamps, if you have pinned the domain wall over here, then it doesn't move at all, you know. So I think there are a lot of extrinsic things that are going on with these devices is my bottom story. And until we learn how to, you know, get all this in somewhat more control, I think it's going to be a little bit tricky digging out detailed physics from it. So in the remaining, 10 minutes or something I have, or 15 minutes, I don't know. I'm going to finish off with some other experiments that we've been doing over the last few years. And the first one is exchange biasing. So as I mentioned before, exchange biasing is something, of course, that's been known for 60 years or whatever, a long time. The basic idea is that if you put an antiferromagnet on top of a ferromagnet, and then you cool down this bilayer in the presence of a magnetic field, then once you cool it down below some characteristic blocking temperature, then there is some there is an exchange field that effectively offsets your hysteresis loop in one direction. And this is, of course, critical for spintronic devices like spin valves and magnetic tunnel junctions and so on. And there is no clear microscopic model, and judging from the literature, trying to understand exchange biasing in some fundamental way. But there are heuristic models that try to look at, that try to relate the exchange biasing field, which is this offset over here, to the interfacial coupling between the antiferromagnet and the ferromagnet, and the magnetization and the thickness of the ferromagnet, and also the anisotropy of the antiferromagnet. So this is something that we wanted to look at, since no one else had actually done it in gallium manganese arsenide. And we hunted around for quite a while and finally figured out that we could exchange bias by using manganese oxide. Manganese oxide is, as some of you might know, a very classic antiferromagnet. If you pick up your Kittel, well, this is one of the examples of an antiferromagnet that's given. It has an AL temperature of 118 Kelvin. So we deposit this manganese oxide on top of gallium manganese arsenide. If you take the sample and you cool it in zero field, then you simply see a hysteresis curve which is centered nicely about zero. But if you compare it to a control sample, which is uncapped, you see that the coercive field has increased. And that's one characteristic sign of exchange biasing. If you now cool this down in the presence of a field, and if you use a field in one direction or a field in the other direction, then you see these clearly offset hysteresis loops, which indicates that you're successful in exchange biasing. And if you work out what is the interfacial coupling energy, which is this product over here, well, that product turns out to be very small. It's a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than what one gets in standard metallic systems that are exchange biased, if you look at the numbers that are given in the literature. So nonetheless, I mean, you can clearly exchange bias gallium manganese arsenide. How well controlled is it? Well, right now it's like making ohmic contacts to a semiconductor. It's roughly about 50% success. So the reason for this is because this interface between the manganese oxide and the gallium manganese arsenide is very, very sensitive to any kind of processing that you do. And so if you have to be very consistent and very careful, but you can get it exchange biased if you do that. So one of the things that one might wonder about is there anything fundamentally interesting or different in exchange biasing of gallium manganese arsenide as opposed to the vast amount of literature in exchange biasing of metallic systems? Well, the one thing that is kind of unusual is that you can easily, with gallium manganese arsenide, look at regimes which are very different from what one gets with standard metallic systems. So for example, in both of these cases that are shown over here, these are just different thicknesses of manganese oxide, but the difference in TC for the gallium manganese arsenide just arises because of, you know, whatever uncontrolled defect diffusion we have in the gallium manganese arsenide. So this layer over here has a Curie temperature of 55 Kelvin. This one over here has a Curie temperature of 90 Kelvin. But you notice that the blocking temperature, which is the temperature at which the exchange biasing disappears, that's indicated by this H sub E. This is the solid symbols over here. That blocking temperature is, in one case, you know, roughly comparable to the Curie temperature, but the other case, it's actually much lower than the Curie temperature. So it's a very different regime than what one encounters with most conventional exchange bias systems in metallic systems. And I think that there are possibly some interesting questions over there to pursue. So the upshot of this is simply that we know how to exchange bias gallium manganese arsenide now. The question is, are there interesting things to do with that? And I would love to talk to people if there are some ideas for experiments that one could pursue. No, manganese oxide. So the way we grow this is that you grow the manganese in your MBE chamber, and that grows as a cubic system, and then you take it out and you let it oxidize. And it turns out that the oxidized film is not a single, well, it's probably a textured polycrystalline film. We're not sure. I mean, we have done electron diffraction in a TEM, and it's a sodium chloride structure. It's not a high quality single crystal, but it's probably well ordered. But it's sodium chloride in structure.
So you have to take pictures somewhere to get a
No, I mean, not as far as we know. So in the films that work, the exchange bias films that work, it appears that it's, and we don't know the details of the interfacial structure, but we don't think there is intermediate phase there. If there is one, it would be at the most a couple of monolayers of something. But if it is there, I don't know what it is. We haven't yet. So there are a couple of experiments we are still trying. One is, could you, for example, put a gate on this and possibly manipulate the exchange biasing by putting a voltage? And the second one is, can you put in, you know, buffer layers in between, some thin intermediate layers? There's one interesting question that actually does arise in the context of the semiconductor, and that is, for any semiconductor at the surface, even with these highly doped gallium manganese arsenide, one would expect that there is some thin depletion layer at the surface. So even if you have 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 21 holes, I think with 10 to the 20 or 21 holes, you're going to have maybe a nanometer or thereabouts.
Yeah, that's like a monolayer.
You know, it's more than a monolayer, I think. So, you know, how the exchange coupling occurs, is it via tunneling through this layer or what? I mean, I don't know. You know, that I think those are certainly some interesting questions to pursue. And then the final thing that I wanted to look at was this idea of annealing of gallium manganese arsenide devices. So as I said, you can anneal gallium manganese arsenide, you can get Curie temperatures, which are up to 170 Kelvin. But supposing you make a device like this. So this is something that, so this is a tunnel junction that we made many years ago, where the gallium manganese arsenide sits underneath several other things, right? And you see, you see nice tunneling, magnetic tunnel junction type behavior. But if you take these devices and anneal them, nothing happens. And in fact, in many cases, the Curie temperature actually goes down instead of going up. So one question is, can you actually make, quote, useful gallium manganese arsenide devices or viable gallium manganese arsenide devices in which the gallium manganese arsenide is buried? And the problem is that with this, this is a study that I did with Peter Schiffer and his postdocs and students, and they showed that when you cap gallium manganese arsenide, even a cap layer as small as 7 monolayers completely suppresses this annealing enhanced TC. So if you look at TC as a function of the number of monolayers of gallium arsenide on top, you find that this enhancement of the TC is completely suppressed. So then the question arose, well, what if you take a device like this and you pattern it so that there are now sidewalls? So now instead of trying to make the interstitials diffuse vertically, you try to provide regions on the side or free surfaces on the side where the interstitials can diffuse. So again, with e-beam lithography, we made wires of gallium manganese arsenide like this, in with widths going from 1 micron down to 70 nanometers, and we made them along different principal crystalline axes. And then we wanted to measure what is the Curie temperature of each of these wires. And to do that, the easiest way to do it is just to do a 4-probe measurement of the resistivity. So as we all know, if you measure the resistivity of gallium manganese arsenide, and this is just a macro sample, an unprocessed sample, you get a peak right close to the TC. And so this is what we decided to use. As you can see with the unprocessed sample, there is no change in Curie temperature. And this is what happens when you pattern the samples down. So here is a comparison for annealed and as-grown wires, which are 1 micron in width. Here it is for 70 nanometers. And you can clearly see that as you go to smaller or thinner samples, thinner wires, then you get this enhancement of the TC as it goes from something like 80 Kelvin up to more than 100 Kelvin in this case. We've looked at wires oriented along different directions, crystalline directions, and there apparently is no difference in the defect diffusion on crystalline direction. So we were hoping to see something, some kind of dependence on the crystalline direction, but we don't see anything like that. We've looked at the Curie temperature as a function of annealing time for wires of different widths. You can see that, again, here's the 1 micron wire. As you anneal it longer and longer, the TC does go up, but much slower than it does for a wire that's, say, 100 nanometers in width. Yeah. This is not Curie. This is the peak in the resistivity, exactly. Yeah. No, not with a single wire. No. If you look at the conductivity at 300 Kelvin as a function of annealing time and compare it to the, quote, Curie temperature as a function of annealing time, you see that there is a correspondence between the two, right? There's some correlation between the two. So the reason for doing this, of course, is was inspired by this paper by Edmonds and others, in which they looked at just a single layer of gallium manganese arsenide, and they looked at the conductivity or resistivity as a function of annealing time, and they were able to model the diffusion of the interstitials using a very simple one-dimensional diffusion model. And we wanted to see now whether this model also applies to the lateral diffusion of the interstitials in our samples. If indeed it applies, then you should be able to scale your conductivity as a function of time in this way, okay? Where in this case now the L is going to be the width of the wire rather than the thickness of the layer. So if you plot, for example, d sigma by dt, we don't have as many measurements as they do because we didn't do this in situ. But if you plot this as a function of t over L squared for wires of different widths, then all these data should have collapsed on top of each other if this kind of model were to apply. And they clearly don't. So it's still an open question for us. We don't have a good model for this lateral diffusion of the interstitials. And
can you put back the annealing figures?
Yeah. Which one? These?
Even more slides. Even more,
okay.
Can you compare the as-grown and annealed?
Yeah.
as you see, I mean, in the amoebas, the resistivity is actually for all weak spot resistance.
It's a different scale here, so you have to be careful about that. Now, if you compare the room temperature and low temperature, there is something funny going on there. But again, there are some details in here that I think are. But if you were confused by this one, this axis is different here.
Oh.
Right. So this resistivity is much smaller than this one. So. Okay. No, it's in a PPMS system. So it's down to, I think, 1.5 Kelvin or something like that. Now, in each of these cases, of course, there's this, you see these upturns at low temperatures. This is, again, something that I'm actually interested in this problem to understand how these interstitials diffuse laterally, and I don't have a model for this so far. So, again, I'd love to talk to anyone about that. I think that pretty much takes me out of my time. So let me just put my outline back again. I hope I've been able to give you at least a reasonable overview of the kinds of experiments that we are currently doing. I'd love to entertain any questions, if there are any. Thanks. Mike. Of the middle layer? Yeah. I mean, that's now that we have this, now that I think we have this spin valve effect, we are starting to play with all the different parameters. And one of them is to try to explore this regime as how you go from a tunneling regime to one where you actually do have the standard spin valve structure. Right. And that can be easily done because all you need to do is just change the beryllium doping in that layer. We don't know. I don't know. There certainly could be, but I really don't know.
So have you tried? Can you measure data from the excursions with slightly tunneled Coleman? Because in case there are many cases that.
I see. Okay. No, we haven't. And again, I would certainly want to.
And also, the question is that for the L you tried, is that the
right.
Similar one with the system that they tried in Adam?
Well, I have their data. Then I can't. What was the thicknesses they used were up to a maximum thickness was about 100 nanometers, if I remember right, was the thickness of the layer. So in our case, the wires go from 1 micron down to 70 nanometers or thereabouts. Yeah. Are you sure? I mean, I haven't. Well, it wasn't. No, maybe I missed this paper. I should look it up. I know that they did tunneling structures where they had. Right, so these were vertical structures where they had a gallium arsenide in between.
Yes.
And this was a paper about spin accumulation.
And in between was metallic.
But it can't have been because it wasn't doped.
But there was some indeed.
Right, and I would be reluctant to believe it because when we grow gallium arsenide at these temperatures, it's certainly not conduct. I mean, you have to go to great pains with the beryllium doping to make it of have any reasonable conductivity,
So between your experiment and their experiment is that you definitely have a highly conductive.
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
Overcome.
Yeah, and we haven't actually tried that. But I think the group in Notre Dame, Fordina's group, I thought had tried playing with putting the P-doped gallium arsenide on top or at the bottom and so on. And they had, for some reason, inconsistent results, if I remember right. But in principle, you know, you should be able to have a, if you had a P-doped gallium arsenide on top, you should be able to almost getter these. But clearly that doesn't happen, because in these trilayers, we do have a P-doped gallium arsenide, and yet the bottom layer does not change its magnetic, it doesn't change its Curie temperature, doesn't change its coercive field. So the interstitials still don't make it, you know. They don't diffuse out. And it's doped at about 10 to the 19, roughly. Mid 10 to the 19, actually, was the doping of the beryllium. We've only been successful with one antiferromagnet, and it's an insulator. Yeah. You mean in metallic systems? You mean, yeah, in metallic systems, they have looked at all sorts of systems. There are insulating antiferromagnets and also metallic antiferromagnets, I'm quite sure. They've looked at both, I think. And so with standard metallic ferromagnets, they've been able to exchange bias them with a variety of antiferromagnets, and both insulating and metallic.